Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from ISF, Incredibly Strange Films and Film and Stuff, and Deviant Legion. And we want to thank you very, very much for joining us tonight. Tonight we will be doing a commentary watch on Windows. Now, with me is my friend and constant guest here by the name of Patrick Crane. Patrick, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
There you are. You disappeared for a second.
Yeah.
So tonight we're going to be doing a film called Windows. Now, I'm going to say this straight out front. This is not exactly my first choice for a Pride Month celebration commentary watch. But I'm going to give this over to Patrick because he pitched this to me. And we're going to be also doing a commentary watch on Cruising in a couple of weeks with Robert Walker. And there is an importance here that we want to talk about. So I'm going to start with you, Patrick. Why did you choose this film, and how does it tie in to Cruising and the gay community at the time?
Well, I chose it mostly because, for one reason, I mean, I thought, oh, it'd be sort of interesting to do a comparison discussion on Cruising and Windows, because they both are interesting. They both come out in 1980, and they both sort of face the same kind of controversy. But so I thought, oh, that would be sort of fun to do a show on both of those. But then I find out that Cruising is being done at a different date, so I'm stuck with Windows by itself. So
we can schedule you in for Cruising too. Don't worry about it. That's
not a
problem.
See. Yeah, we'll see. But Windows is a movie from 1980, from the same year Cruising came out, and it is where Cruising was very controversial because of its portrayal of homosexual men. Windows was controversial because of its portrayal of lesbian women, and in neither case is representation good in either movie. I think they're interesting because also in 1980, Dress to Kill comes out. So there was a lot of this kind of trying to get these themes into sort of mainstream entertainment and maybe being clumsy at doing so. But they become sort of interesting historical artifacts when you get some time, between you. Because now, Cruising, everybody acknowledges that that they have problems with it, and it's not the best film in terms of representation. But people tend to kind of take it on its own terms as either a slasher film with a gay angle to it, and also for the locations that William Friedkin really went to that are no longer there, capturing a time and a place that's gone with the wind. So Cruising has sort of had a critical reassessment and people kind of enjoy it for what it is. I enjoy it for what it is. But Windows, not so much. Windows has not gotten that kind of reassessment, and I think many reasons. I think that's unfortunate because I think Windows, like Cruising, is a very interesting movie. And I think it works as an effectively creepy thriller like Cruising does.
Yeah, for me, one of the things in rewatching some of this, I didn't get all the way through it. Now, I watched this years and years ago on HBO, and to be honest, that was the last time I've seen it. But one of the things I did notice, and that I do want to bring out before we start watching the film and commenting on it, is the director. The director is Gordon Willis. Now, Gordon Willis, this is the only film he directed, but he was one of the great cinematographers. And the thing that really hit me with the opening sequence and a couple other sequences It's just the lighting, all of that is so atmospheric in this film. And you'll see it right from the beginning, what he does with it. And though I do not feel that this is a successful film, it is one that you can certainly see talent behind. And I think we'll also talk about certainly Talia Shire and Elizabeth Ashley in this too, and their work in the film. Now, this is on Amazon, and if you are an Amazon subscriber, it is free and Prime Video, okay? And I am basically set up right at 000 and ready to go. So I want to make sure that you're ready to go, Patrick.
I am ready to go.
All right. And so we're going to start this, folks. So what I'm going to do is count down for 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, then go, and we start at go. So everybody, if you're not ready, get ready, pause it here, and then come back to us because we're going to start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
Got that United Artists, that old Transamerica
yep.
United Artists logo that I love so much. What Transamerica was doing with United Artists, as anybody's guess.
Yeah, absolutely. They were in bed with each other. God knows what the sax was like. Look at this shot.
Right.
Where the hell
That's
is
great.
This?
That I don't know. Of course, this is the art gallery that we, you know, that we'll be introduced to. This looks like a Michael Mann shot. This looks like, you know, something from like Miami, not Miami Vice, like Thief or something. This is very, the neon.
Yeah.
I love it. There's our girl, Talia Shire.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Talia Shire was well known for playing mousy women at this point in time. Between,
I got to say, in Godfather 2, she's a raging force of nature, and she was actually nominated for that before she was nominated for Rocky. But, yeah, this performance is more tuned to the Adrian character from Rocky in the first or second Rocky film. And as a matter of fact,
right.
I think this was shot not too long after close to Rocky 2.
Yeah.
So this is where we find that these are married people that are getting a divorce.
Yep.
You know, the independence that we're trying to establish for Talia Shire's character.
And Ennio Morricone did the score
to
this.
Yeah. It's a gorgeous score.
Not one of his more
really
well-known scores,
good.
That's for sure. No.
No, not at all. Yeah, I mean, like, again, there's a lot of great talent behind this film. I agree with you just from the start that it's not entirely successful in what it wants to do, but it's one of those movies, I think, that the sum of the parts are greater than the whole. And, again, Gordon Willis doing his own cinematography, which is not entirely normal or common, but, you know, how can you resist if you're Gordon Willis?
Yeah, exactly. I think the main problem with this film is the script by Barry Siegel. I think he doesn't drive into it. He drives into it with the tropes as opposed to real sense of what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. This movie really gets by on its cinematography, its mood, and Elizabeth Ashley, who we'll get into when she shows up, because she's incredible
yeah.
in this. And it's not that I dislike Talia Shire, but, you know, she's a very mousy kind of character in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, all of this, I love all of the location shooting in this. And
and look, like the head, her head is almost like detached, the way that's shot,
oh, yeah.
right? So,
Yeah. A lot of, this movie is very dark, obviously, because, you know, Gordon Willis, that was his sort of his stock and trade. But this movie really, really leans into the darkness. And it being a thriller, that sort of tracks and makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I was talking to Stephen Ronquillo, my former partner, whom you know, and I told him we were going to do a watch on this, and you chose it. His first words out of his mouth is like, why? And there are reasons for that. Uh-oh.
Yeah. And this cat here who plays the attacker, this is one of the two guys that are outside of the movie theater in Annie Hall. You recognize his profile. You know, he's got that Rondo Hatton profile.
Yeah, he does.
This scene is really effective. This is, of course, the attack in her apartment. And I love the way this is played, and I love the way this is shot.
Yeah, whenever I see these type of scenes, I kind of curl up in a ball.
Oh, yeah. These are not, obviously, they're not played for you to be, passive. I mean, they're very visceral and whatnot. And it all depends on whether I feel these are being sexualized or exploitative. And this, I think, is really selling just how terrifying this is. And it's, and you know, I was watching Lipstick earlier today. The Lamont Johnson movie with Margot Meredith, anyway.
God.
Right, and well, I mean, you compare the assault scene in that, that's really long and drawn out, but so elegantly shot in a way to really kind of titillate. You see a stark difference in the professionalism and how the seriousness of this particular scene played versus something like Lipstick, which purports to be a serious issue film about rape, but it's much more exploitative than this sequence, which I feel really is terrifying and as far as these things can be tastefully done.
Well, he's focusing on the knife on her mouth and throat. And this had to be tough for Shire to do. That's an actual friggin' knife. I don't think that's a prop knife.
No, that looks real. Yep. This is a tough scene to play from her point of view, for sure.
And there's the cat in the back.
The cat plays an important part in this movie.
Yes.
There we go. We got a fade up. We got a fade up to the next morning, and that's a gorgeous
fade.
That's a gorgeous skyline right there. Gone with the Wind again. And here comes Elizabeth Ashley. Here we go. I'll say this: her performance in this is incredible. I mean, you know, her character may be, poorly conceived or ill-conceived, but she came to work. I mean, she's good in this, really good.
You know, I'm checking now because I do need to check this. You know, I know the name Elizabeth Ashley very well, but I don't really remember what she's done so much.
I looked her up when I was watching this because I think like the first time I saw this, her performance really struck me. And so I she seems like somebody that I'd seen in something before. But I couldn't really place what it was. And I think when I went through her filmography, I didn't really see a whole lot that I had seen her in.
Well, I will say this. She is currently in Russian Doll, and she's fucking great in Russian Doll.
So there you go. Still working. That's good.
You know, lots of TV, tons of TV.
Yeah. And that for me, you know, television for me is like, I might have seen you, but probably didn't. I don't really watch a whole lot of television. So, you know.
Oh, she was Dr. Glazer in Vampire's Kiss.
Oh, okay. Well, it's been years since I've seen that. I've seen that all of one time.
She was in Coma.
Coma?
Oh, 92 in the Shade and Rancho Deluxe. That's what I remember her from.
Okay.
That's right. It.
Oh, this is Clumsy right here. The insert of the close-up of the stuttering books and, you know, that's some clumsy storytelling. But I do love
how
beautiful
the shot this is. By the way, it's gorgeous. I have to say I am very, very, I'm predilected to like movies with cats in them. I'm just saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, cats are great. I love cats. I've got a cat myself.
And that's the older gentleman in the suit is Joe Cortez, right?
Yeah, Joe Cortez. Yeah. Yep. Sometimes Willis's compositions really resemble the ones from Interiors. That he had shot 2 years prior. He really, the way he frames them, it really reminds me and reminiscent of Interiors. There's a stillness to this movie.
Emily, if he's done this kind of thing before, and he's going to ask to give her a chance, she used to have some different problems again.
Oh, she is up to no good.
No.
And I will say that I think that is one thing about the movie that I'm that is wrong with the screenplay. It sort of telegraphs that way too early, I think. You know, it doesn't let this relationship sort of grow organically. I mean, like right from the get-go, maybe not necessarily here, but soon you realize that she is this neighbor is more than just a concerned neighbor. I feel like it would have possibly been more beneficial had that relationship sort of grown a little and then to find out.
Or
it was
shown at the beginning that it was there already, right?
Well, there's a detail that gets revealed here shortly that like gives it all away. I mean, you know that she's, you know, an obsessive, you know, psychopath who has an unrequited crush on Talia Shire. But, you know, once you know that, it robs the film of some level of suspense. It is what it is. But that's, I think, one of the movie's problems, the script's problems, is that it decided that it was going to reveal that early on, you know. So, because it, like I said, it's explicit here within the next 10 minutes, it seems.
You know, I mean, you talk about next door neighbors, right? And with evil intentions. And I always go to Ruth Gordon. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Always go to Ruth Gordon
not,
for that.
Who turns out not even to be a next-door neighbor? She's in the same room. You know,
yeah.
that apartment was all one big apartment. And, you know, there's that passageway that you can get through. But, yeah. Oh, you know, that's the cast of that's the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Lufrono. Yeah.
You know, so we know what's going on, and of course we've already telegraphed it in our commentary, that you have basically a very much a mentally disturbed lesbian. Again, not the best representation. However, the thing about this movie that I've noticed is look how quiet it is right now. And
oh yeah,
this is not. And you mentioned it during the rape scene too. How it's shot, it's not exploitative. I remember seeing this and knowing that people didn't like it, and I wasn't thrilled with it. But I thought there was a lot of artistry in this film. And that's one of the reasons I agreed to do this today. Again, you know, we like to do films on Deviant Legion that celebrate pride. And certainly I got one that I want to talk to you about. I'll message you after this that I'd like to do at one point if I can find it. But this is really, really a good film. God. By the way, not the same cat as in The Long Goodbye, but looks exactly like the cat in The Long Goodbye.
Yeah, it looks a little bit like Jones from Alien as well.
Yes. And that, I think that is Jones, actually. I think so.
These movies, this would fit in a class of films that all seemed to come out in 1980, at least, that were sort of part of a gay panic thing where, you know, they had this Dress to Kill and Cruising. You had these antagonists that were poor representations of the LGBTQ community. But again, I think the films themselves, while not celebratory, I think are sort of a piece of Hollywood's troubled history with LGBTQ characters and the slow movement to sort of acceptance towards, you know, in 1980, it just seemed like there was something in the water.
And I think there was, actually. You know, there had been previous films in the 70s that at least had a much more kind view of the gay community. And one that I love and the one I was going to mention is Outrageous. I love Outrageous. I think that was the first film I saw that was LGBTQ positive, even though people have problems with the last 10 minutes of it, and I understand that. But nonetheless.
I don't even know if I've seen Outrageous.
Sort of pre Queen of the Desert, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, sort of.
I got you.
I love these shots, these superimposed shots.
Oh, yeah.
They're so wonderful.
Give me late 70s, early 80s New York exterior shots. I mean, of course, I love them. I'll eat them up. And this movie in particular is really good at showing them off.
Hi, it's your new neighbor.
Yeah, the introduction of the neighbors. And I do love this scene. This scene's very well done and sort of conveying the uncomfortableness of the position she's in. And I think this is just so, you know, well shot. And because I love this piece and this gallery that they're building, this goofy Yeah, she's having to explain to her ex-husband, you know, what's happened without being able to explicitly telling him what's happened in front of these strangers. She just needs somebody to come and get the rest of her stuff and move it into her new place. I love that it's a very simple thing that she's having to do, but she's being exposed to, like, you know, these people that she doesn't know, and so she's having to tiptoe around it. And I love this. I love this whole scene. I love the way it's played and the way it's shot.
Mm-hmm. I'll send somebody over.
Grayson. 8 o'clock.
And I do like these characters. They're nice little pieces of detail in this movie. I mean, you know, they're stock, but these performances are good by these two. And I really do like this little detail because they come back into the plot later.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about New York, and I lived in New York from 81 to 87, is that neighbors were kind of cool. A lot of people think, you know, the New York is so rude and that, and I don't see that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's, you know, that's like, you know, every place has that kind of, you know, it has some kind of a reputation that's probably not 100% correct.
Well, the cinematography here is what absolutely blows me away. Shifting the focus, you know, from one side to the other where she is in those exterior shots.
Oh, yeah. See, here we go. Here's where we. Yeah. We kind of find out here that, yes, she is somehow connected to the attack that happened to Talia Shire, Elizabeth Ashley.
Right.
And I love all these night shots, the exterior night shots in New York. I'm in love with those. And here's this great score by Marconi.
Yeah, that's a big mistake. This early. That's a
right.
big
so
mistake.
Like, you know, yeah, for,
that's
so now
script.
We know, right. I mean, we didn't have to know that. There was a way to keep that from the audience, you know.
Right.
But yeah, that gives the way the game so early. We always know she's a threat, you know. But I still think that it does. I mean, the movie still does generate some really nice moments as we, you know, go along. It's not a fatal mistake, but it is a problem with the screenplay. And had this movie been a better one, it could have overcome that particular mistake.
You know, the one thing, you know, this film absolutely destroyed his directorial career. Never did another film as director. But, man, you cannot complain about the cinematography. And the shots and
no,
everything
a,
about this.
It is it's a great looking movie. And I, you know, he later admitted that the material he was not well suited to, but he also really wasn't well suited to being a director. He admitted that, like, it is just not, he's not the type of personality to take phone calls in the middle of the night with the actors on the other end of the line saying, I can't figure out my motivation. I can't figure out where my character's coming from. I mean, that's something that he said about this experience, that he just wasn't, you know, as a director, these are things that you have to put up with. As a director of photography,
right.
they're not something you have to put up with. So, you know, it's a different skill set, and I don't think that he had it in kind of relating to, you know, characters and whatnot. But, you know, that being said, again, like you said, this movie gets by, in my opinion, on its cinematography, which is just absolutely gorgeous, gore, a couple of set pieces, and Elizabeth Ashley's performance. I think those things are what really make this movie successful
mm-hmm.
on its own terms. That is not Jones, by the way. Jones's face is bigger, puffier.
Oh, okay. Body
lash. Are you all right?
Oh yeah, the macrame. She has the macrame hanging plant. That is so 70s. I love about movies in 1980 are really just 1970 movies, and I love that all of
they are
around. You know.
Yeah, Steven says the same thing. You know, even
yeah.
81,
yeah,
they're shot in 79
that. I don't think we really get into the 80s proper until about 84, late 83, early 84, really. That's what, when people think of the 80s, that's what they're thinking of. Late, like, maybe more 84, because even something like The Big Chill, that still has some kind of a 70s vibe. I mean, it's definitely set in the early 80s, but it's still a semi-intelligent film where people just kind of sit around and talk, you know. Amongst a lot of earth tones. We don't get into the red, white, and blue and the pastels and stuff until 84, Miami Vice, really, and mostly.
The other thing about the 80s, too, is the horror content in the 80s, because once you get into, you know, Camp Crystal Lake and all the slasher films, most people will deal with that, and that is definitely.
That's an effective scare.
Yes. Well done.
Yeah, I thought that's an effective cheap scare, but it's effective. You don't see it coming. You know, again, this movie is supposed to be a thriller, like a, you know, horror thriller type film, and in some ways it does. Succeed, and it gives off you know, it does, you know, conjure up.
That's
the
what
right,
it's supposed to do.
It gets it right from again, and it, you know, like, it just again, I love Elizabeth Ashley. She's, you know, she's playing this, you know, repellent person, but yeah, she just you know, she takes everything over in this film. I mean, her whole, you know, she just sort of engulfs everything.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that wicker medicine cabinet.
Yeah. You know,
well,
the other thing I'm seeing at this is all the wood. Wood.
That's heavy wood too, right?
Yeah.
Dark wood, heavy. Yeah, that's and Gordon Willis liked that. It gives it a richness. It gives us, you know, the film a real you know, a nice texture and color palette. And you know, Gordon Willis trended to the dark, you know, side of things in his vision in terms of his cinematography. And I think that, you know, those that stuff lends so well to that. That kind of the woods and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. The other thing we're about to also kind of get into here is another weak part of the screenplay, and it may very just well be that these two have no chemistry, but they kind of have a like a romantic relationship that I just you do not feel. There is no energy in this at all.
No. And I'm going to give people. I'm going to give people a little background on Joe Cortese. So you know he's still acting. But if you take a look at him, this is probably his first real role. But I also remember him in a movie called Evil Speak, where he was Reverend Jameson. Evil character in that, by the way. Lots of TV. He also was in one of my problematic Larry Cohen films, and that was Deadly Illusion.
Oh, I didn't know he was in Deadly Illusion. I have not seen that. That was the one that Larry Cohen was fired after like
exactly.
A couple of days or a week or something.
But what I remember Cortese from most is Curtis Harrington's Ruby. Has a great role in that.
Ooh, I actually have that movie. I've not yet watched it, but I do love the Curtis Harrington movies I've seen, and I really dig him. So I've been looking forward to getting to that. It seems like every time I start a Curtis Harrington run, I abandon it within three or four movies because I get sidetracked. But I'm anxious to finally watch Ruby.
Mm-hmm. Joe Cortese also had a major role in American History X. And as I said, still acting today. He actually had a small role in Green Book, which is interesting.
I don't know if, is Talia Shire still doing anything? I mean, I've seen her pop up on occasion. Like I saw her in I Heart Huckabees. She popped up in that because Jason Schwartzman is her son and he's in it. But I don't know if I see her much anymore.
Let me just, here I'll check. Hold on.
Because she was, you know, obviously she's the sister of Francis Ford Coppola and that's where she started making her bones were in Roger Corman movies. She was in Gas. And then, and then of course she was Connie Corleone in Godfather 1, 2, and 3, nominated for two Best Supporting Actress. And then she was in a movie called Old Boyfriends, which I never
yes,
seen.
Yes, which I love, by the way.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
And that was written by Paul Schrader. That was written by Paul Schrader. I love that one.
And is it?
Yeah.
I thought it was
yeah
okay well and I but John Belushi's in it. I remember the premise of it or I remember when reading about it, and I've always kind of been curious to see it. But then of course she's Adrian in Rocky, and then she was nominated for Best Actress for that movie, then she just sort of I guess she just mostly was right in Rocky movies. And what else did she do? Godfather 3, which she's great in, but she didn't, you know, she didn't really do a whole lot after.
Now she did. She's got a movie coming out called Chantilly Bridge. She did a lot of TV movies and indies. Not any real like. Films that I know, to be honest. She played a role in Blossom on TV. Godfather 3, all the Rocky movies. And that's basically it.
See, she just sort of, you know, I mean, she proved herself as a fine actress. She got two Oscar nominations, which, you know, that generally shows you're not a one-off fluke. I thought she showed great range in the Rocky and Godfather movies. I think her arc her character arc and all of those, both of those series are very good, especially Godfather. I'm a firm defender of Godfather 3, and I think she's great in it. I love how Elizabeth Ashley is dressed. Compared to Talia Shire. Talia Shire literally looks like she just walked out of the pet store in Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and Elizabeth Ashley looks like she's getting ready to book passage on the Love Boat in this outfit.
Mm-hmm.
With this, the way she's waving around this this wine goblet with her feathered hairdo, very sultry. See, the cat knows.
And the cat knows.
Yeah.
The cat fucking knows.
Yeah, yeah. The cat knows. Man, that chair, that green chair, I know exactly how that feels. I know that.
Yeah, so
I know that. I know that. Yeah. That's some hard leather. I love how, you know, the thing about the stillness of this movie is that, you know, he really does just park his camera and let the scene play out without a lot of dollies, and you got a little bit of a follow here, but really the camera is pretty nailed down, much again, like I said, you know, like in Interiors. I think Interiors, it's all nailed down except for when Geraldine Page runs out of the church, and then when they're walking on the beach,
right.
Everything else is pretty still, and he brought that sort of calmness to this movie, which is very interesting because it gets very tense, and it's an interesting mix of moods.
And you're right, there's no fucking chemistry.
No, yeah, this is all, you know, they don't generate any kind of sparks whatsoever, and it's also like it seems like semi inappropriate for the police officer that's investigating her assault to also be like getting romantically involved. It's a movie. It happens all the time. But it just feels, I don't know, she's been attacked and, like, sexually assaulted. But handle a little bit more care and caution and professionalism there.
All right.
Thanks for talking.
You know, I would buy it more if it was an older detective and it was more like him trying to be the father, right? I could buy that.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't work. This angle just does not work from a script standpoint, nor from a performance standpoint. Oh, those sunglasses are bitching.
Yeah.
that head flip is great. Okay, now, this is another thing. This whole thing, I know that it's the cab driver that, you know, Elizabeth Ashley knows and is, you know, set up. But this is quite a coincidence that she would get into this cab and this would work out this way is highly unlikely, even knowing how it unfolded in the story. It just doesn't, this whole bit where she's in the cab with the guy that attacked her is ridiculous. It's well played.
Yeah,
but
yeah, and that's the script problem. That's a script problem.
Absolutely.
It makes no fucking sense.
Contrivance. You could have fixed that by just having her randomly get into a cab somewhere. Maybe.
Right.
This whole thing, the way this whole thing works is, yeah. And then, like Dress to Kill, this movie spends a lot of time in the shrink's office. You know. Of course, in Dress to Kill, it's the shrink that's the killer. But, you know, spoiler alert. But this whole bit really lets Elizabeth Ashley, like, kind of sink her teeth into this role.
Right.
I mean, this is probably why she took the job, because, I mean, this is some juicy stuff she gets to do. Right. I do like that, how this, they, what he does with it. He does generate some suspense. It is kind of well done. It's sort of De Palma-esque in a way.
Absolutely. I was thinking that myself.
But De Palma films work on their artifice, you know? I mean, they have to be contrived in a way for them to sort of unspool the way they do. This movie is not that kind of a clever kind of film. So this whole bit, again, I don't buy it. It's, you know, well done.
And that's the problem with this movie. You don't buy it, right? And it's unfortunate.
Right. No. Yeah. On the whole, that's a lot of this movie's problems. Is, you know, like, there are elements of it that just do not work. I mean, on the issue of, you know, the representation issue, obviously, it's got a lot of flaws. But, you know, there's something about it that I still kind of love. It mostly that it's, you know, Gordon Willis's one and only movie makes it, you know, notable. And again, where it fits in those films that came out in the late 70s, early 80s, that, you know, basically villainized, you know, gay people. It's a curious entry in that cycle. And again, mostly forgotten. Unlike Cruising or unlike Dress to Kill, Windows just does not get any kind of sort of recognition. I mean, this Screen Factory put together a nice Blu-ray. That's what I'm watching. A few years ago, and it's got interviews with Elizabeth Ashley, and it's got interviews with Talia Shire. So they did some, you know, they did some work to get these people to talk about the movie. So, you know, it has been upgraded. It's not out there languishing on VHS only or something like that. But you just don't hear people talk about it at all, like you do Cruising or Dress to Kill.
Well, you know, I think part of that is that people don't know this film at all.
Yeah.
It absolutely died at the box office. It was critically absolutely pummeled. You know, and again, the thing that I love about this film is the sense that you really see.
They got him. Movie's over.
Yep.
That's it. That's the end of Windows. They got the perpetrator. That's it.
No, but, it's not.
Yeah, no. If only.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned De Palma, and the thing about De Palma, though it's very, very, you know, apparent and that sort of thing, to me, it's De Palma's editing that makes De Palma films work. And Willis was not an editor. So I think De Palma was able to work, you know, and because he was a Hitchcock fan, and Hitchcock was very much into the editing part of it too. And I think that's a main difference here. You see how beautiful the cinematography is here, but it's not the editing. Mm-hmm. It's not, he doesn't ramp up the heat, so to speak, right?
No. And that's, you know, there's a difference in filmmakers who, you know, basically edit in their mind and shoot that way, and that's a De Palma, or a filmmaker who likes to shoot a lot of coverage and have choices in the editing room. And I have the feeling that was probably Gordon Willis this particular case, because, you know, when you shoot like De Palma, you have a natural sense of how this is going to flow, what the rhythm is going to be like, where I need to cut, how, and once it's cut together, you know what it's going to look like. You know how it's going to flow. You know, where with something like Windows, it's an assemblage, I think, of, you know, beautiful shots. But, again, it's a movie that's made in the editing room or assembled in the editing room. And I think that it does feel like something that was, not as much as pre-prepared as Palmer.
De Palma.
Yeah, I mean, like, these scenes work, but only from the point of view of the voyeurism, in my opinion. And again, back to De Palma, here we've got Gordon Willis doing his Rear Window, which, you know, De Palma did with Body Double,
right,
and many of his films he at least references Rear Window. But, of course, this is more explicit with the person looking, you know. And then there's a lot of – there's a cat and mouse thing that will happen later with across the street. I'll tell you what this also reminds me of a little bit. And I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it's a John Carpenter movie called Someone's Watching Me with Lauren Hutton.
Yes.
And it was made – yeah, it's made for television. And it's a kind of a Rear Window riff in a way. But it's a very strong kind of independent woman film, and it's striking how much stronger her character is than Talia Shire's in this film.
I like this here, by the way.
It makes, oh yeah.
The
oh yeah.
That particular shot.
I love this bit. How we used to watch.
Yeah, put the TV in
there. Watch movies. You know, in a barely furnished apartment. I love this.
And again, I love the cat. That's a great composition right there. That really is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was, yeah. And not easy to get a cat to stay still.
Now, what movie is this? I'm trying to think.
I don't know. And I'm ashamed. I probably should. But, I don't know what movie this is.
It looks like a Douglas Sirk film, actually.
Could be.
One of the, you know, 50s melodrama, at least. Right? I think so, but I can't I can't place it.
I'm not as well versed in Douglas Sirk as I probably should be.
Okay, I'm going to check this, okay?
Yeah, go ahead. I tried to look earlier today. I tried to, but I was coming up nothing. The mm-hmm. The character's name is Charlotte. The female character right. within that movie, her name is Charlotte. If that can help you out, if that's a detail that you need.
Right. Okay, give me a second here. Okay.
The sequence is just, yeah, boy, the heat, the electricity.
Yeah.
Too much. And then, she's having her cigarette like she's had an orgasm, just watching them, you know, with very sultry.
Mm-hmm. So I just found out that this film is called Windows, and that was actually one of the titles that Woody Allen was considering for Interiors.
Well, see, there you go. There's that Woody Allen Interiors connection again.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that, you know, it sounds like the sequel to Interiors.
Oh, get this. Guess who auditioned for Lefrano for the Joe Cortese role?
Who?
Bill Murray.
Wow. That would have been an interesting... Bill Murray always trying to do drama from the get-go. That would have been an interesting...
Yeah.
Oh, that's a gorgeous shot of the cat.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. I love these profile shots, the way they're lit.
Yeah.
Gordon Willis.
And the way it's lit,
you
see the outline, that's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. And then we go, you know, we move back to the, you know, to her shrink's office. Again, once you've sprung the trap on, you know, what happened, and, you know, there's nowhere for this movie to really go. I mean, you know, it's inevitable they're going to have a confrontation, but there's no real
tension.
There's no real tension. It's, you know, and there's no real dynamic. It feels like I know where this is going to go. We just have to do this very slow, you know, dance through molasses to finally get to the stuff that we need to get to. But you know,
right.
I get it. That this is, you know, this is a swing for the fences type performance for Elizabeth Ashley, but it doesn't. It just doesn't make for a compelling thriller.
Mm-hmm. And that's right. That's the word. It's not compelling.
I mean,
yeah.
It wants to be too classy, in a way where
look at that background, man.
I mean, look at those. Yeah, the green. How the lights come off green. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, she is listening to the tape. So, you know, for those that aren't watching but are just listening, for whoever that might be, we know that Elizabeth Ashley set up the attack at the beginning so that the attacker would record him assaulting Talia Shire so she could continue to listen to it over and over again. So throughout this movie, Elizabeth Ashley continually puts the tape on and
audio
on white wine. Yeah.
God.
I love that shot. Oh, I love that bridge shot right there. It's so good.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Now, we do keep coming back to this shot a lot, of this exterior in this position. Like, he left the, you know, he just shot this at like two different times of the day. And, I mean, that exterior establishing shot is used many times.
Mm-hmm. Ah, the best sweater. God, I miss those.
Yeah.
Yeah, the costume design is so 70s here. Good God.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know. Elizabeth Ashley gets all the best clothes in this movie.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. you know, the 70s were the decade where they made us wear shit that we would never get laid in, like bell-bottom pants. Seriously.
Right. Well, yeah, and those, you know, the advent in polyester was terrible.
Oh, I mean, Orlon and any of those stupid fucking things, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I do like this bit where, you know, she calls to interrupt, you know, it's Hitchcockian, but I still like it.
Yeah.
But think about how much more effective this would be if we didn't know these things already, like what's going on. And, like, no matter where she moved, no matter what she did, she was still being harassed, and you never, you know, she could never be free of this thing that had happened to her. And then you spring it on at the end that it's, you know, her neighbor, you know, that's been doing this to her. Again, I just don't really understand why.
Well, that's the problem with the script. And this script needed at least a couple more rewrites. There's no doubt about it.
Oh,
and it's not
so
much the dialogue, it's the way that he presents it. Right?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, again, like we said, now here we are back in the shrink's office. And again, this movie is something, it's a story that moves between like three different places. You know, either Elizabeth Ashley is spying on Talia Shire or she's in her shrink's office. And Talia Shire is either in her apartment or with the cop again, somewhere, you know, like in his office. And then there's the art gallery too.
There's the art gallery too.
Well, we haven't gone back there except the one, you know, the one time with the right with the phone call to the ex-husband.
Right.
Have we been back since then?
Mm-hmm. No.
I mean, this movie is very static, and again, there's sort of that's something about it that I kind of like. Like you said, it's stillness. I really dig, but it's, I guess maybe it's a little inert, maybe I should say.
Now the psychiatrist, let's talk about him so that people know who he is. And let me get there for a moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, who is this actor? I'm not sure who this actor is. It's funny because when I was watching him, I was like, for whatever reason, for one half second, I thought he was the guy from the Doris Wishman movie that I watched last night. It wasn't, though, don't worry.
Uh-huh. His name is Michael Lipton.
Ashley. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What else has he done?
He had a small role in Network, Hercules in New York, and A Man Called Adam.
Boy. Okay. Wow. Well, that's that's prestigious. Elizabeth Ashley has now gone around the bend. She's got herself all worked up, and now she's sick. Now her neighbor is missing, and the cat is missing, so that can't be good.
He did a lot of TV in the 50s. A Man Called Adam, which was with Sammy Davis Jr., and Network, he had a very tiny role in Network, and he was Pluto in Hercules in New York, God help us all. And then he was on Somerset, which was a TV series soap in 76 that only lasted 11 episodes.
Okay. Who is this lady that's playing the neighbor? She looks
familiar. Oh, you know what? It's her last role. Give me a second. I'll tell you who it is. That's Kay Medford.
Okay.
That's Kay Medford. And she died this year. She died in 1980.
Oh, okay.
This was her last
okay.
film,
so
I think.
Is, yeah.
She was on Barney Miller a lot. She did
yeah.
Windows. Fire Sale, she was Ruth Fiscus in Fire Sale, awful movie. She was performer on the Dean Martin Show. Angel in My Pocket. Funny Girl, she was the mother in Funny Girl. She was Rose.
Okay.
Ensign Pulver, head nurse. And then bunches of stuff in the 50s and 60s. Face in the Crowd. I know her basically from Funny Girl. That's who I know her from.
Okay.
Again, the
yeah,
one thing that I have against this film is that the shots are repetitive. I'm noticing that more and more.
Yeah. Like I said, that exterior shot's used a lot. This, of course, this setup is used a lot. The telescope, you know, this profile shot, obviously, you know, they shot her in this profile one day and they cut that scene up or cut that shot up to, you know. And so there's, yeah, I mean, again, I don't know if there's a lot of confidence in his, you know, in his direction. I mean, again, it's, this is also an issue with preparation for your film.
Right.
You know, and again, here we go, where we were in the across the way apartment peeping in. Now we're back in the shrink's office. I mean, again, this is like a home base. We keep coming back to this
mm-hmm.
joint. And now he's telling her that he thinks it's time that she goes to the hospital, that she be admitted to a psychiatric ward. He's breaking the news to her.
By the way, I've sat in that Naga High chair several times. I'm just saying. Again, I love the shot of the silhouettes. That's fucking gorgeous.
Yes. Yep. And now she's returning home, and what, cops are just all over the place. Boy, what could this be? This can't be good. Uh-oh. I think they found the neighbor. Mm. Yep. Looking for the cat. There he is. There's that neighbor. We found him.
Yeah.
Man. You know, Talia Shire was a fan of the knitted hats.
Yeah.
Here in Rocky wearing them, and in Rocky II, that was her look.
No, the lack of chemistry, it's unfortunate because I think Cortese does a decent job here. They just don't have chemistry.
I think he's good in a very understated kind of leading man kind of way. I really honestly think, you know, again, Talia Shire's good at, I don't know, she's good at some things. But here, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the way she's approaching her character, and she's being withdrawn, but it just doesn't work in terms of them developing a relationship from a viewer's point of view.
Right.
Because, you know, like, you know, when she falls in love with Rocky, you buy that. You buy that she's in love with that guy she's married in The Godfather. Godfather 2, you buy her as this, you know, high class, you know, or high end woman of leisure a little bit, you know.
And you buy her an old boyfriend. Trust me. You buy her an old boyfriend.
See, I need to see that. I need to see that, you know. Uh-oh. Yeah, see, the doctor has come to take Elizabeth Ashley to the hospital. He's going to escort her because he's a nice guy. But that's not what's happening. Now, she's got other plans. I do like the way that this is played. Yeah. And I gotta say this is sort of a basic contrivance too. This whole bit where the more, you know, flustered she becomes, the stuttering is a device in this, sort of like it is in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
With the Brad Dourif character, and we have the courage, he doesn't do it, and then as her that's supposed to be the tension in this movie, I guess, that we're supposed to feel is when she starts to, you know, feel the tension and starts to stutter, I believe that we're supposed to feel it. I feel that it's more of a contrived, you know, storytelling detail.
No, it is. It's extremely contrived. You know, I mean, all the bad tropes are here, Patrick.
Yeah,
the maniacal lesbian, all this, and there we are back to that shot.
Right.
By the way, this does make Brooklyn look really, really good.
Right. This apartment that she's in, though, the lack of any sort of like art on the wall, because I know she just moved. Okay, now here's a part that's kind of upsetting. If you were rooting for the cat, and I gotta say, that's a good looking. I have a feeling that's real. But that's an effective jolt, I think.
Yes.
Especially if you're an animal lover. And especially if you're a cat lover, especially.
And I'm a cat lover. Yeah.
So, you know, you hate to see that, but you kind of saw that one coming.
Yeah. Well, the cat did scratch Elizabeth Ashley. Cat fucking knew.
Oh, yeah, she knew. Or he knew. That cat's a tabby, so it's more than likely. It's a yellow cat, so it's more than likely a boy. Okay, so now this is a real dumb sort of bullshit thing. She calls the boyfriend, she called the cops. And they tell her, you know, stay there, but then, you know, she gets so easily rooked over to, you know, another one of these things that I'm like, oh boy, if only.
Yeah. This makes no sense.
She's going. Yeah, why would she, you know, well, I mean, I get it. She has not had the kind of relationship with this woman where I feel that she would run to, you know, to be in a time of crisis. She's not her go-to person. You know,
no.
I just don't feel like they've had that kind of relationship, you know.
No.
That's
why
been,
I said at the beginning, let's see the relationship at the beginning before all this starts. So
yeah.
That you set it up that they do have a relationship. Right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, that's, you know, we spent all this time knowing that there was this malevolence in this in this relationship, where we could have been spending that time in her office with the shrink, we could have been spending time watching that relationship grow and then been surprised at the end that she was behind everything.
Right.
You know, but again, it's just, that's a major problem with this movie's script, is that it just decided early on that it was going to reveal its hand, and hope that the dramatics, and the character development of the Elizabeth Ashley character was going to carry the film, and it doesn't. And of course, neither does the little light romance between Tali Shire and Joseph Cortez. So, you know, you're left with a movie that has a lot of really interesting things going for it that add up to, I feel, something that's worth at least talking about and revisiting, even if it's not entirely successful.
Right.
And I gotta say that I also think one of the reasons that Cruising has probably been reassessed a lot is because it's got a lot of things in it that people would kind of, you know, ironically enjoy, like, you know, the scene of Al Pacino, you know, a permed Al Pacino dancing on the dance floor with, you know, eyeliner on, I think has sort of a weird camp value that people like to, and so I think there's a revisibility to that, revisibility. There, we'll just say that. Where this one doesn't quite have that. I mean, this movie doesn't really have a lot that people would go in and be able to appreciate on a, I think, sort of on an entertaining level.
Okay, so the one thing about Cruising that I need to say at this point is it really is evocative of a specific subset of the gay community. And you see, you know, the Hellfire Club, and you see all of this things. And there are scenes in there that are just iconic. The Powers Booth scene with the hankies is just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, and there is camp value there. And there's no camp value at all in this film. None.
No. You know, the thing about Cruising is that I do think that's creepy. The lit from behind where all you can see is her outline of her, you know. The thing about Cruising is that, I feel that it's more that not everybody in the gay community is part of this subset that Cruising is showing, you know, that it's focusing on. The thing about Windows is that this movie has one gay character in it, and and she's horrible. You know, so there's 100% of the gay characters in Windows are murderous characters, where it's not really the case in Cruising.
Interesting thing, too, we should mention is the release. Okay, so this was released a month before Cruising, and then 3 months after that, you got Dressed to Kill. So within 4 months, you got three very anti-gay films.
Yeah, right. And you know, of course, this all coincides with the presidential election of 1980, which is the end of 1980.
Right.
Which portend poorly for gay people in America.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just a weird time because, you know, I don't think that Gordon Willis or William Friedkin or Brian De Palma are people that have, you know, malice or are bad people. I mean, really, it's just a weird thing that's what the culture, our culture at that time, that these things were not, from their point of view, you know, they didn't have the foresight to understand how these things would be seen and how these things would be,
right.
received, and you know, they were sort of taken aback, which sort of lets you know they must not have been attuned to anything really. But yeah, I mean, there's historically, it's just an interesting thing that these movies, you know, were released so close to each other, and that they all sort of have the same problems. I mean, in terms of representation, obviously. I mean, Dress to Kill, I mean, you know, full disclosure, I love Dress to Kill. I think it's brilliant. But again, from talking from a, you know, just a sociopolitical standpoint, these movies all have the exact same problem.
Yes. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not fond of any of the three of them. Though I have agreed to do two of them this year, so you know at least there's something to watch here. I just want to point this out. In 1981, the year after this, you had three anti-gay films, and then you had three werewolf films in 81. So, you know, I don't know why you get these clusters. And if you forget which three I'm talking about, of course, The Howling, American Werewolf in London. And then Wolfen. So I don't know, but there always seems to be these cluster of films.
When's Full Moon High? In Full Moon High 81 as well?
Yes, Full Moon High was 81 too. I kind of forget that
there
one because
go.
I just consider that, you know, that's a Coen film. That's not exactly
sure.
a werewolf film. It's
yeah,
better
I,
than Teen Wolf,
and-
though.
Oh, yeah, it is. Well, I look at The Howling as a Joe Dante movie, so there you go. And, I, you know, people look at American Werewolf in London as a John Landis movie, you know. But they are all, you know, they
and
all came out.
And then people look at The Wolfen and say, what the fuck was that?
I love Wolfen. Oh, I love Wolfen. Wolfen is my...
We'll have to do,
I mean,
we'll have
I,
to do a commentary watch
yeah.
on Wolfen. I love that movie. Fucking love that movie.
Oh, yeah, Wolfen, my... You know, I tell a joke that 90% of my medical knowledge comes from Wolfen. I love the police procedural, you know, the police procedural aspect of Wolfen. I love its crazy Native American stuff that it's trying to do. And it, and I love Albert Finney. I love Diane Venora. I love Gregory Hines is so fucking good in that movie. And I love the Wolf Cam. I love that shit. And don't get me started on all the Urban Decay, which I love. I love a movie.
Okay,
talk about the Urban Decay.
I know we're talking about Wolfen now. We should hold this off until we do a commentary on that.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just telling you what's coming if we talk about it. But I'm just talking about the Urban Decay. Okay, Elizabeth Ashley is going right for the fences here. This is the big climax.
Okay, so we're going to shut up here. I do think that this is well shot, and I think he, you know, I do think that the tension here works pretty well.
No, this is well done, actually, this bit. And Talia Shire's performance here is really good. This scene is really, really good. It would have been better had it been, you know, more of a reveal to the audience
right.
as well as Talia Shire. But.
I don't know if these were the movies that really destroyed both their careers. Of course, Talia Shire still had Godfathers in her and Rockies in her. But you know, Elizabeth Ashley basically went to TV from here.
Yeah. Talia Shire never really, you know, had to... I mean, because, yeah, Rocky, she was on the Rocky train. So she was, you know, she's Rocky 2, 3, and 4. Or Rocky 2, 3, 4, and 5.
She's on the Godfather train.
Yeah, she had one more of those in her. So, I mean, you know, but yeah, I can imagine this doing some damage to your career, kind of like cruising. You know,
yeah.
Was a strike against Pacino. He didn't completely strike out until Revolution. That was the movie that got him exiled for a few years. But, you know, Cruising was the first big, you know, Bobby Deerfield, I think, was the first one that people were like, eh. Oh, and this is dumb how he figures this out. this doesn't really, like, this doesn't strike me as a detail that would crack the case, but I guess Joe Cortez is just more clever than I am. Realizes the Andrea, the Elizabeth Ashley character's address page has been torn out, so he figures it out here. Last name is G. But yeah, Cruising pretty much tripped Al Pacino up, and then in Justice for All he got an Oscar nomination, but you know. After that, Scarface was pretty, you know, that movie was not loved when it came out. Author, that movie was not loved when it came out. And then Revolution. I don't know if you've ever seen Revolution. But
that's the film. I have seen it once, but it made no impression on me.
Yeah. I recently watched it. I watched that whatever it's called, the director's cut of it, or the, you know, whatever. And you know, it's not terrible. I mean, it's got some nice stuff going for it.
This is uncomfortable for me, which it's supposed to be, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like, you know, Talia Shire does not. She has no. It's Elizabeth. The thing about Elizabeth Ashley is that she lives in this kind of, you know, state of delusion, and so her, you know, her fantasy collides with Talia Shire's very uncomfortable reality, and it makes for a very unsettling and emotionally disquieting scene.
Right.
And this is where Talia Shire really does a good job, I think, because she looks terrified and she looks, you know, she looks
devastated. She's trying to hold it together to survive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a clumsy giallo or something.
Yeah. Right, right. There is a giallo sense to this.
Like one of those.
And the Italians do it better.
Right. Well, it also helps that Ennio Morricone's doing the score, and he scored quite a few giallos in his day.
Right. And it's not worth
it. Not,
you know. It's more in the background, his score in this film. You know, there are no noticeable themes, so to speak, right?
No, this is very lilting, you know, score. If you ever watch, some of it's very reminiscent of the score for DocuSucker in terms of that movie has some very emotionally charged sequences, and during those moments, his score is very lilting and very soft, and it's very reminiscent of this film. And of course, we revisit the assault from the, you know, beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
We replay it here with Elizabeth Ashley, but Talia Shire is she has sort of gained the confidence, and it's just not going to go the same way.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And that's part of what this movie is about, is, you know, her gaining strength through a terrible thing that happened to her. And there are many of us that have done that.
Yes. This is a survivor movie. I mean, you know, it's a movie about, you know, she's getting a divorce, so she's becoming independent, you know, and then this thing happens to her. But, you know, she's got to, where, you know, in most movies she would have a strong female ally. Her female ally is a traitor. And that's,
right.
You know, that's an interesting little wrinkle in this film that I find interesting. And she has to overcome not, you know, the normal misogynistic stuff that, you know, you would figure she would have to face, even though she does face that. She's got this very, very, you know, poorly motivated person in her life, which, you know, makes her struggle a little bit more interesting than in a lot of films of its kind.
Yeah. But you're absolutely right about Elizabeth Ashland. She does really good.
Oh, yeah. I think she's really terrific in this movie. Like, really, really good. I mean, if she sort of outclasses the material.
Easily.
That's fair, because she feels like she's in a whole different movie, or she feels like she is the one that really understood the assignment, I guess.
Right.
Because this sequence is really, really, like I said, it's really well done. I just love all of her sequences, even if I find them to be, you know, in parts of the movie, like, again, the continual revisiting of her psychiatrist's office, is tiring. It's tiring. But she's good in every one of those scenes. So, you know.
You're bleeding a little bit, I think.
What'd you say?
The sound was coming through. From the film. I think that was you. It might have been me. I turned it down more.
It was me. It must have been. I think I'm about a half second ahead of you or a second ahead of you. So.
This is really good. She's really good here. God damn.
Oh. Talia Shire. Taking control.
Yeah.
See, and then, of course, that's where the worm turns, and, you know. So that's the moment where, you know, Talia Shire sort of, you know, gains her strength.
Gains the upper hand.
And so, yeah.
She gets the upper hand here.
And I love that, yeah, she just keeps saying, don't hurt me, which is what Talia Shire was saying at the beginning to her attacker.
Right.
I will say this, you know, good. I don't know why it's such a weird day that I decided to do that, but I, you know, like I said, I watched Lipstick earlier today, and when I compare this with Lipstick, I mean, this movie is just such a, you know, much more, you know, classy production than that movie, but it's still
not
great. Oh, yeah. I guess I should have listened to you then. I guess. But y'all weren't solving the case. Yeah. I love that shot, though. I mean,
that's a nice shot.
Yeah. I love how it feels like, you know, you could just walk further down along the shore, and you'd find that spot in Manhattan, where Woody Allen and Diane Keaton sit on the bench, and you know, next to the Brooklyn Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that. You know, that this film feels geographically close to Manhattan. Well, there
well, it's
we go.
Brooklyn Heights.
There was
no,
windows.
It's right across.
Okay. And this is the.
And of course, don't forget
the,
that Wolfen was down in Battery Park for most of it. What?
Or is this the.
Say
is
that
this
again?
The Narrows Bridge. Is this the Brooklyn Bridge or the Narrows Bridge?
That's the Brooklyn Bridge. That's Brooklyn.
Okay.
Now, I've got to say this. This is not nearly as bad as his reputation. Reputation's pretty bad. Not nearly as bad as that.
No, no. I think, you know, again, I think these movies, not all of them will have value when you go and you watch these movies from a different time that were, you know, completely trashed. But, you know,
right.
9 times out of 10, you'll find something in them that make them worth watching, you know. And in that case, like I'd say something like, you know, Roman Polanski's Pirates. You know, it's not ever going to be anybody's favorite Roman Polanski movie. But it's not as, you know, you'd have thought he would have murdered that entire cast. Or something, or
mm-hmm.
they would have set fire to a village or something. The reputation it has, it's not that bad. I mean, it's gorgeous,
no.
And it's sumptuous, and you know. And in this particular case, you know, this is the only movie Gordon Willis ever made, so there's value in that, and it's beautifully shot, and Elizabeth Ashley is excellent in it, and I like its sort of quiet, still mood. So that's what I like about this film.
You know, of course, if you're looking through the prism of LGBTQ, there's a lot to dislike about the movie. And
oh, so.
I think one of the things we have to do, you know, in the community is take a look and try to reevaluate, you know, what the societal viewpoint was at that time. And you bring it out specifically that there's three films in 1980 that are extremely problematic for LGBTQ within 4 or 5 months of each other, you know, and why was that? Why was that? I think part of it is that there's a real change from the 70s into the 80s. And don't forget, you mentioned that we're right before Reagan is elected as president. So there's a move to the right. We talk about the slashers in the 80s, and they're all Reagan films. It's all that if you do something, you know, if you are not normal, then you are a killer. And if you have sex, you're going to be a victim. If you're going to be this, you're going to be a victim. And that was very much a social movement that happened in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's reflected specifically with films like this. So I think you have to take a look at context at the time that these things were made. Correct? You would agree with me on that?
Oh, certainly. You always have to judge movies, you know, in art, really sort of in the time in which these things were made and what these things were, you know, speaking to and what these things were reacting against or pushing back against. I mean, and like you said, you know, again, we see creeping conservatism in our movies probably the year before. There becomes a real kind of sort of discontent with Jimmy Carter. And so there seems to be this sort of push against a lot of things, because like in 1979, what wins Best Picture? Kramer versus Kramer, which is nothing but really a pushback against feminism. And, you know, so
right.
That movie has a kind of a really sort of conservative undercurrent. And I think those things sort of came into our art a lot just because that was the time, and these things sort of insidiously seep their way into our art sometimes by people who are otherwise very progressive people. I mean, like, again, Brian De Palma is a very progressive person. I believe Gordon Willis was. William Friedkin at the time was. He's sort of off the deep end now. But,
I'll go off the deep end with Friedkin any day of the week.
All right. Yeah. No, I'd be a huge William Friedkin fan and lover of him and his films. But, you know, I think that, you know, the times affect the art, and, you know, you don't get a lot of pushback in your popular, you know, in your popular entertainment, especially when the 80s came around. If you want that, you have to go.
Don't forget what won the Oscar for 1980 that was presented in 81. And that's Ordinary People. And that's another
Ordinary
one.
Ordinary People.
Like Kramer versus Kramer, very anti-woman in a lot of ways because of the Mary Tyler Moore
absolutely
character.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, these were just, these were the times, and they were dark times. So, you know, it took a while for, you know, Hollywood to sort of get that right, you know. It wasn't Hollywood,
you take a look at some of the foreign stuff, and you take a look at what came out in the mid-80s with Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and those that were much more attuned to celebrating LGBTQ films. And then, of course, with the AIDS crisis and that all changed, you know, and I think in many ways, you know, the vilification of the LGBTQ community in its own way, I think AIDS had somewhat of a positive effect when you look at films like, though I don't like the film Philadelphia, but if you look at Longtime Companions, you look at some of the AIDS survival films, you start to see a compassion through the straight, you know, prism, straight man prism, because how, you know, and I think these change over the times, and I think also we're going to get into a situation here, you know, now with the anti-trans movement and such, where you're going to see more and more positive, you know, portrayals from parts of the community like the trans, because, you know, if you push back, there's, you know, just like anything else, with one force you have an equal anti-force that, so, you know, you get that societally in any decade. You can tell if you really look at a decade of film, a decade of art, decade of music, you can tell where the needle drops and where things change. And certainly, you know, as you get on to the 80s, things change quite a bit for the gay community and portrayals.
Absolutely.
So Patrick, I want to thank you so much for suggesting this and actually making me do this, because this would not be one I would have picked, but I'm glad we did. So I want to give you a little bit of time just to do a little bit of promotion for yourself. So tell us what's going on in Oklahoma City and what you're doing and what you're writing about these days. So go on, give us a little promo here.
Well, right now I'm, as people may know, I'm one of the programmers for the Oklahoma Film Society, and next Thursday, not today, a week from today, we will be showing Liquid Sky down at the Paramount Room down on Film Row, starting at 7. It's a free show. That's going to be our pride pick. Liquid Sky is such a great movie. I absolutely love that movie, and I think it'll look really good. If we can get a crowd out, it'll play really well.
I got to interrupt here for a moment, because I was actually at the New York City premiere of that in 1982. And I met Slava Zuckerman. And that was a time where I was trying to get into the no-budget films and the Lydia Lunch and so on and so forth. So I was that's a great film, and you definitely need to have people go see it. So go ahead. Go on.
Oh, I'm excited to show it to people, and mostly because, you know, I think it's such a great little oddball and colorful film. It also has the very last screen presence or performance of Paula Shepherd, who I think is one of the great unsung child actors of all time. She's only in two movies, Alice, Sweet Alice and Liquid Sky, and she steals both films. I swear to God, I wish there was in an alternate universe, there is a Little Darlings movie that's got her and Linda Mance in it, and it's the best thing you've never seen. So anyway, come on out to see Liquid Sky. 7 o'clock, it's free. It's a great film. Beautiful capturing of the new wave scene in New York in the early 80s. Very colorful. Gender bending, got sex, drugs, aliens, orgasms. It's a great movie. And as far as what I'm up to, I finished my Russ Meyer set last month and have sort of been trying to figure out what I wanted, how I wanted to continue, what directors I wanted to continue going down. I'd started a lot of threads in these essays I've been writing for my site, which is apolloswim.com. I have decided that I will probably finish out the Michael and Roberta Finley's films. So over the last week or so, I've been going through their early stuff and writing some stuff down on that. So I should be publishing those pretty soon, starting with Take Me Naked, followed closely by the Flesh Trilogy, and then A Thousand Pleasures. And then I'm going to go back and look at a couple of early Michael Finley movies, and then I'm going to continue forward until I go through all of those. And I don't know who I'll do after the Finleys. I'm completely immersed in their world. And it's a terrible, sick, and beautiful thing to be in.
Well, I tell you what, if you want to do a commentary on any of the Finleys, let me know. We'd be glad to do a commentary with you on any of those. I had a chance.
Oh, absolutely.
Stephen Ronquillo made me do one of the Flesh Trilogy, and I just fucking loved it. So, yeah, I'm there for it if you want to do it.
The Flesh Trilogy is so good. Speaking of slasher films, this is the, sort of the progenitor of the slasher film or the Flesh movies. I mean, the Flesh Trilogy is just such a great early pro slasher series that I couldn't believe it when I saw it. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with those.
Now as far as Deviant Legion, tomorrow Adam Ferenc is going to be doing a episode of Cafe Roy Mission, and we're going to be looking at LGBTQ representation in TV and the seminal points where LGBTQ representation was shown to be positive and things like that. And we're going to be doing that, and I'll be part of that tomorrow. Then on Saturday, I'm pretty sure this will be in the evening. I have to talk to Rachel. But we're going to be doing a commentary watch on V for Vendetta on Saturday. And then on Sunday, Rock This Town with TC, our radio show, will be on, and that's Sunday from 8 until generally around 9:30. And then I just got a message from Dan Kramer. We're going to be doing a next week, not set in stone yet as far as the day is concerned, but we're going to be doing a history of LGBTQ cinema with Dan Kramer. And Dan is a director out of San Francisco, and his movie Overwhelm the Sky, which I was at the New York premiere of, that is available through Kino Lorber. That was released last year, and he's got a number of other things that are happening. He's also done several commentaries, and he's doing also trailer commentaries for Trailers from Hell. So we'll be, I'm very happy to have him, and he's a good friend of the podcast. He's been on a lot of times. So that's what we've got so far set up for the month. There are more things happening. I can tell you that cruising will happen as a commentary watch, not next week, but the week after. We just have to set that up with Robert Walker. Robert Walker is a director who's done a short film called The Black Doodler, based on a serial killer that focused on the gay community in San Francisco in the 70s. And he's trying to make that into a feature film. So that's what we have set up right now. And Patrick, as always, you're welcome back anytime. Anytime you want to do anything, just let me know. We'll set it up. It's always great to have you, man.
Well, it's great to be on. Thank you. And I, you know, I will be on. I will be on again. I have no doubt. And I will enjoy it then as much as I enjoyed it this evening.
Well, I think you're one of our best commentators. I truly mean that. And it's always a pleasure to be with you. And so right now, I'll just say thank you very, very much for joining us. Please don't forget, we've got a show tomorrow at 8 p.m. on LGBTQ TV representation, cathode ray emission. And you can follow all of us at Blog Talk Radio or through follow me on Facebook, Carl Kafer. And thank you very, very much. And we'll just say good night. Thanks a lot, Patrick. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.